All right, and welcome back from the intermission, ladies and gentlemen. This will be released as part two of episode three. So think of this as the Empire Strikes Back of, you know, this particular episode. But our first section, we talked with our special guest, Kit Olson, about the Son of Sam and the big conspiracy slash satanic cult, satanic pact, all that crud that happened after Berkowitz murdered a bunch of people in New York. But this section here is going to be the main theme. It's going to be a little bit spicy, ladies and gentlemen. So we are talking about John Wilkes Booth. Now, many people know John Wilkes Booth as the man who assassinated President Abraham Lincoln, and he did do that, absolutely. But he was a terrible person before that.
Oh, excellent.
Absolutely. I'm just here to make sure that everybody remembers him even worse than he was before.
I really can't wait. I know very little about John Wilkes Booth, so I'm very excited you're going to educate me.
Well, there are actually a lot of people who know a lot about John Wilkes Booth. When I was doing research, I discovered that the people who do, like, Abraham Lincoln assassination history, mm-hmm. who've recorded a lot of John Wilkes Booth, like, life, they're very... aggressive.
Passionate?
Passionate is the right word. One or two of the books I read have these reviews online that are like, this is drivel. It's all wrong.
Oh my god.
That's not where he was. We have recorded. But keep in mind, the things that I'm talking... So, you know, the Son of Sam's happened in 1976, right? In the 1970s?
Yep, 1976, 77.
So the assassinations happened in, you know, the early 1800s, maybe. I should know that. I should know. What I'm saying is, it's going to be pretty murky from here. There's a lot of things that we can't know for sure, but we're going to do the best of our knowledge to try and cover. But John Wilkes Booth, after he shot President Lincoln, was actually chased for 12 days. So he jumped down onto the stage. There's confusion about whether or not that jump broke his leg. He did suffer a leg injury at some point in his escape, because when he was eventually killed, they found him with a busted up leg.
Okay.
But, you know, he jumps onto the stage, he shouts, "Sic Semper Tyrannis," which is, thus is the way of tyrants, which is also the Virginia state motto, actually. Because, you know, a lot of these state mottos were set up a long time ago.
Yes.
Maybe it's thus always the tyrants. I'm not great with Latin. But he jumps on stage, he shouts, and then he runs away. 12 days later, he's finally apprehended by all these detectives and military personnel who are hunting him. So he's in this tobacco barn in Virginia.
Okay.
And so he's deep, way out in the woods here. He's in this tobacco barn. And so these officers come up and they say, "We've got you surrounded. We know you're in here. You need to come out or we're going to burn the barn down with you inside."
Oh.
And so he has an accomplice at this point.
Sure.
Another member of the conspiracy, because John Wilkes Booth actually managed to put together, I'll talk about it a little bit later briefly, he put together about four or five different people, including a prostitute that he was, visiting on the regular.
Okay.
But they were all involved. He was trying to take out Abraham Lincoln, the Secretary of State, and the Vice President all in one night. He was hoping to cut the head off the Union all in one night.
That is ambitious.
It was ambitious, and he was not great at any of this. The reason that only Abraham Lincoln got killed that evening is because his plan was, A, bad, and it was, you know, he got lucky. He got lucky because, you know, there was no Secret Service at this time.
Yep.
And because he was, you know, a working actor in the theater where the president was. So anybody who saw him was just like, "Oh, hey, John.
Yeah,
how
exactly.
are you?" He's like, "I'm busy.
I might have a broken leg.
I've got things to do."
I may or may not.
So anyway, his conspirator who is in the barn with him gives up. Says, okay, I'm done. Great, take me to prison.
Yeah.
Don't burn me alive. I don't want to be burned alive. Booth, at this point, has a broken leg,
mm-hmm.
is hungry and tired and cold, but he's still... A main thing we're going to kind of find out is that Booth believes himself to be a Greek hero.
Okay.
Because he's raised on Shakespeare, so all he does is he reads these Greek tragedies, especially, of course, his big inspiration, a lot of people know this, was the story of Caesar, of Julius Caesar.
Sure.
He believes himself to be Brutus.
Okay.
He thinks that he's Brutus, and he's not. He's a bad person who
believes in bad things.
He's
a terrible person.
And he's bad, but so every time you hear John Wilkes, if you're ever wondering about his motivations, it's because he believes he is the hero of a Greek tragedy.
Okay.
So he's inside and he goes, "I'm not coming out. Come in and fight me. One by one. I'll duel you." He literally says to 12 men with rifles surrounding this barn, he goes, "Come 1v1 me." And they're like, "No!
No.
We're going to burn the barn down.
Burn the barn.
Not one of us is going to die so that you can go out in a duel.
Yeah.
And so they start burning the barn down, and Booth stays in for as long as he can, but eventually he's either going to burn to death or he's coming out. Mm-hmm. So he comes out, and the moment he comes out, he fires off a couple of shots to try and instigate a fight, because he wants to go down like a hero, mm-hmm. right? He fires off a couple of shots, and it's unsure who killed him, but it is most often reported as the sergeant who was there, one of the people who literally, because there were a bunch of people who brought a bunch of his belongings back to prove that Booth was dead.
Okay.
Because at that time, you know, you could telegraph, but like, sure. you know, the people who were going to be dispensing rewards, the people mm-hmm. who were going to be running the newspapers, the government wanted proof.
Yes.
That, you know, Booth was dead.
Yeah, can't go by word of mouth.
Yeah, so one of these guys, he shoots Booth and he paralyzes him. So he shoots him in the spine. And of course, this is not on purpose.
Yeah,
you know,
no, it, still, that's a...
A little kill cam from Fallout didn't like... no, but he gets shot and it paralyzes his spine. And so he's still alive, but he can't really move. His body's not moving
that's
very well.
Go. I mean, I realize he's a terrible person. But...
Yeah. Well, it does. It's a bad way to go. I mean, getting shot with a rifle back at that time was awful.
Yes.
It wasn't like, oh, the bullet enters your heart. No. A ball the size of, you know, about a, you know, a gumball hits you and then parts of your body implode.
Yep.
So his spine gets paralyzed. He gets dragged over to the porch so they can start going through his pockets because they're like, we will get the body back in like 2 or 3 days, but we can send somebody ahead on a fast horse. So they find on him a couple different things. They find a knife, a compass. They find the gun, the one that he used to shoot Lincoln with. But the most important thing that they find is his diary.
Oh.
Because, of course...
What
you know
Greek
our,
hero doesn't keep a record of his
exploits? You know our boy kept a diary.
Absolutely.
Not that if you
dear
keep a diary...
Dear diary. Today, I'm going to kill... Abraham Lincoln and little hearts on the eyes.
I have some quotes from his diary that I will read later.
I am so ready.
He is a lot. And I would like to remind you that when Booth died, he was in his mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
His mid to early 20s. I believe, and I'll confirm this, it's in the book, I think he was 23.
Okay.
He was younger. He was, you know, a lot of people, if you're younger than 18 listening to this, you're not going to be an adult when you turn 18. You're not going to be an adult when you turn 25. And so, you know, he was a kid,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, anyway, he gets his pockets gone through, and they pull out his diary, and they find all these passages saying, okay, this is what we're doing. I really hope we're going to do this. I hope we can make it. Oh, so-and-so's not going well. But at the end of the diary, they find 5 photographs. And each one of them is of a different woman.
Oh.
And those are the people we're going to be focusing on. Yes. Oh, the tea.
I am ready. Please
yes.
spill it.
I
am sure it is scalding.
So, you know, it is. He was a bad person. So the first thing that we should know is, so these photographs are not, because whenever you see, like, hear about photographs of women, these are not, like, boudoir pictures. That's not really something that happened back then. At that time, you couldn't have someone take a racy photograph of you without that cameraman and 15 other people being present to make that happen.
Yes.
So these were something called carte de vistes, or carte de viche, I don't know how to pronounce it, but they were basically something that you would buy, as most of these women were actresses, because Booth was an actor. And so he gets involved with all these different actresses. All four of them are actresses. The fifth one is not an actress, but we will get to her later. She is kind of the pinnacle of his achievements, shall we say, in dirty air quotes with disrespect for him.
Yes.
And then as we begin talking about these women, there are many other women that I won't mention.
Oh, okay.
These are the five.
These
that
are the
we
five
will.
That matter.
These are the five that. These are the five that matter. But I want to be clear. Every time I move to a different woman,
mm-hmm.
imagine just insert 12
just
prostitutes
like another
here.
12 prostitutes.
Insert
and then
12
woman.
Prostitutes here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So
what I'm hearing is that John Wilkes Booth was just
exceptionally amorous.
Yes.
Yes, he was very horny. He was a
yes.
horny boy.
Yes.
So, like I said, this is a little spicy. So
okay.
he gets shot, but once they start pulling these photographs out, they immediately dismiss them because they're not going to be used as part of the case against the conspirators. So these kind of get ignored for quite a long time, but we do now, after a lot of research, we know who all these women are. We know that these women are Helen Wester, Effie Gurman, Fanny Brown, people did have silly names back then, yes.
Yes.
Alice Gray and Lucy Hale. So we'll start with...
That last name sounds familiar.
It is.
Yeah.
It should be familiar. She is the most important one. Not the most important, but certainly the most famous after the fact.
Sure.
His mother, important women we'll talk about, was Henrietta Irving, Ella Starr, and then Louise Wooster.
Excellent.
But again, in between all of those names,
just
insert,
like a dozen prostitutes.
Insert a dozen prostitutes.
Okay.
Again. So Booth was actually infamous for loving women, and they indeed loved him back. See, Booth and his father Junius were well-known womanizers. They had both left a trail of broken hearts and ruined careers as they moved around the country on the acting circuit. You see, this was something that actors did. They would move from city to city playing. They would stay
the,
in the theaters.
The touring troops kind of.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. And Booth was actually not famous for most of his career. Keeping in mind, he was only famous for probably about the last 3 years of his career, and before that, he was just some guy. He would play stock characters.
Sure.
And he often lived in the shadow of his father and brother, who were both also actors. So Junius Booth, Junius was actually an actor in England, got married, and then fled to America, leaving his wife and child behind, and then started a whole new family in America. Because that was the kind of guy he was.
Incredible. We're off to a great start.
Yeah. So you see where he gets
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I can see with a family life like that, you know, it kind of makes sense.
Well, also, actually, it was a little bit interesting back then. So if you were an adulterer back then, it was considered really, really bad. It would destroy you as a person. So he gets married, Junius does, he gets married to this woman, he has a son with her, and then he says, I'm gonna go make my fortune in America as an actor, and I'll send you back money. And so he does this, and he does not see her for 20 years. She eventually shows up 20 years later after he has, I mean, probably at 7 or 8 children in America with this new wife, and she's like, I want a divorce, and I want half of your money, I want everything. And so he actually gets away with it for about 2 years because you can't bring a lawsuit unless you're a citizen.
Sure.
So she had to wait for like 2 years to become a citizen, and then she could make him file.
Okay.
She could file for divorce with him.
Okay, but can I just say that alone, like the admiration for this woman, just like through the roof. Like she's over here, she's like, I want what I am owed, and I am going to stay here for 2 whole years. I'm going to go through hell in immigration's customs, and I am going to get my goddamn money.
Can you imagine coming up to the visa counter and being like, so why are you becoming a citizen? Do you have family here? I have two families here, actually. so I'll just mark that down as, revenge. Mark
revenge.
It as revenge.
It's revenge. That's all this is.
So once Junius, you know, kind of does this, Booth is the youngest child in the family, so Booth sees at a very young age his father getting attacked as, you know, this adulterer and this slanderer. His older brother Edwin is also an actor, but Booth kind of grows up and becomes an actor as well and becomes indescribably handsome. The book I read, written by Lawrence Abel, it really goes into it. Apparently, John Wilkes Booth was very hot. For all the things an assassin to be, hot is a weird thing.
I feel like that's a delightful thing.
A delightful thing?
It's a delightful thing to focus on. Like, you know, there are all these other, you know, people, notable killers throughout, you know, whatever, and they're just like, oh yeah, you know, he was really cunning. He was really smart. No. John Wilkes Booth? Just hot. Like
Zac
12
Efron.
out of 10. Just, have you seen that man's calves?
Very, very hot. So John Wilkes Booth is described as a handsome man with dark curly hair, fair skin, and deep dark eyes. You can actually see pictures of him. There's a picture on the book I have right here. But it's if you're listening to this, you can easily Google a picture of him. I don't think he was that hot, but I'm just not into mustaches. And that was really his big...
See.
Yeah, that's a picture of him right there.
I mean, the mustache is
The mustache
kind of,
is a lot.
Look, it's kind of a lot. It's kind of a lot.
Yeah. His looks made him attractive, but his performances are what made him magnetic. So he was determined to distance himself from his much more classically trained brother and father, Edwin and Junius. So Booth decided, at the time, the tradition of acting was to be very reserved and very, emotionally poignant. Booth decided, no, he was going to be very physical and very aggressive emotionally. So he was often a lead in Juliet. Which order are those things?
Romeo and Juliet, the
play where they all die. not Hamlet, not King Lear. No, Romeo and Juliet, the one where they all die.
Yes.
But so he often played the lead in Romeo and Juliet. He played with Romeo. So he portrayed a hot-blooded and passionate lover that shocked and intrigued audiences. There's a quote from a woman who played Juliet, Kate Reingolds, who played against him in 1861. And she, her direct quote, and this is to like a magazine at the time, which is what you would call a newspaper, how he threw me about. So apparently, during that particular performance that she's referencing, he apparently acted so hard and threw her around so much that she lost both of her shoes, and by the end of the show, her dress had been shredded.
Oh my God.
not to the point where it was like risque,
yeah,
but to the point where like he was tossing her around. On a slightly other note, if you've ever been in an acting space, if you've ever been in a theater, if you mess up a costume...
I was about to say the same thing. I'm just over here and I'm like, I cannot imagine. Like this is 1861 too, so like,
oh, yeah.
They're sewing machines? No.
This is all
by hand.
All
and the fabrics? The fabrics in 1861, man. That's not
absolutely
easy to work with.
No. It's... People, like, costumes were legacy items. They would be passed from actor to actor.
Exactly.
He
ripped just over
her
here
dress.
Ripping the dress that has probably been used for Juliet for, like, the last 60 years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You can't get fabric like that anymore.
No,
you can't repair it.
But apparently, you know, stage managers and angry costumers notwithstanding, it made him incredibly popular.
Right.
People loved it. They really liked to see it. And in particular, women loved him. You see, romance and tragedies were kind of the bread and butter that he had. And so while not on stage, he often spent time in the company of his adoring fans. Women would flock to the stage door to see him after shows.
Mm-hmm.
And he is reportedly the first actor to ever have his clothes torn by fans who were desperate to touch him.
Ooh, okay. So he was the rock star then.
He was a rock star.
Yeah, you know, he's the red carpet sort of thing, you know.
Absolutely.
Like, if there were paparazzi, just be there.
So I used to live in Columbus, Georgia. There was there's a theater there called the Springer Opera House that John Wilkes Booth never performed in, although he did perform at a place called Temperance Hall in Columbus.
Okay.
But Edwin performed in the Springer Opera House. There was a hotel right across the street from it called the Rankin Hotel.
Okay.
There was a tunnel that led from the Springer Opera House to the Rankin because this was such a problem. Because as they got more and more famous, people wanted to touch them. People wanted to be in their face.
Exactly.
And
so,
soon it was an issue.
Yeah. You know, so it turned into like, all right, we need a safe way to get the actors off.
Absolutely.
And somewhere safe where they can rest.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, it was very strange because Edwin and John Wilkes Booth were rock stars, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But rock stars that literally ate in the same hotels that you did and would live maybe 15 yards, 20 yards from where they were performing.
Sure.
So they had a lot more access to people back
then.
In fact, you know, you could get access to even people like, I don't know, presidents. There was a lot of security. So Booth was incredibly popular. In fact, one of his most avid fans was actually dying of typhus. It was a Miss Beckett of Richmond, Virginia. As she was dying of typhus, she sent a letter to Booth talking about how much she loved him, how she'd seen him in a couple of plays, and included in the letter in a small parcel was all of her hair. She had had it cut off because she was about to die of typhus, and she wanted to present it to him as a gift. Booth appreciated the gift so much, he had it made into a stage wig, and he wore it on stage for the rest of his career. So anytime he needed to look differently or use some hair that wasn't his own, he wore a wig made of a dead woman's hair.
I was gonna say this sounds like some really horrifying version of the Make-A-Wish Foundation gone wrong.
I mean, in a small way, it's very sweet because she did love him.
Exactly, but at the same time, like, sure, honey, you might have loved him, but he has no idea who you are. He just really likes the mop of hair.
He does like the hair. I will say, before we get into what a terrible person he is, one last thing that was noted about him as a nicety.
Okay.
He received hundreds of love letters. Right? That was very common.
Sure.
People would send him letters. And it was very, very dangerous for people to send letters like this because they would send amorous things.
Of course.
Nasty things.
Of course.
You know, in 1861, nasty terms. But people would send him letters. Women would send him letters. Sometimes married women, sometimes unmarried women. Both of those are bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Both of those bad.
It's 1861, so any of that comes out and it's hey, your reputation is gone.
Absolutely.
You got nothing.
So he had a, like, he would often share dressing rooms with this man. So this one guy, he reported to, Booth would get his love letters, and then he would open them. He wouldn't read them. He would just take a pair of scissors. He would cut the signatures off. And then he would throw them away separately.
Okay.
And then, so this actor who was in the dressing room with him said, do you mind if I read the letter? He pulls up this one that says, it has the signature already cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And says, do you mind if I read this letter? And Booth goes, no, don't read it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to read it.
Yeah.
There's no need to impure her honor.
Sure.
Even, like, we're not going to read it.
Yeah.
And so apparently he received dozens of love letters and...
And never read.
Never read them. Didn't
just
read them.
Got rid of the signatures so that they would be anonymous and then...
Yeah, threw them away.
Threw them away.
Which was very, very nice. But apparently... You know, women who were in his field of vision were not offered that same nicety.
Yeah, apparently.
So, the first, we'll go in order of the pictures, right?
All
right. So, we'll go in, like, picture order chronologically. So, in 1861, Booth is performing and he meets a sister act called the Western Sisters, Helen and Lucille. So, they performed a popular show at the time. It was a cross-dressing comedy show. Which was actually very common. So it was like a burlesque where, because women weren't allowed to wear things that were risque. So if you wanted to wear something that was risque on stage, it had to be as a man. Because men could wear like bathing costumes and different things. And it was a very thin veneer that allowed it to work. So they do this show full of sexual innuendo and very short costumes, and they were called the Star Sisters because the Western Sisters wasn't a great name for them. So they made quite a splash. I have a quote from the New York Post about them. Quite offensive. That was all the New York Post said
that.
About the show.
I love that. No, that's...
Quite offensive.
You know, it's punchy, it's to the point.
For a burlesque show, it's fantastic advertising.
Absolutely.
It's
great
advertising.
No, if you're doing burlesque, like, that's... You want to catch people's attention.
Did you see what the newspaper said about us, Lucille? They said that we were offensive. Said we were quite offensive.
Quite offensive.
Excellent. So they were on the rise. They were making quite a lot of money until they encountered Booth.
Mm.
So Booth met and made quite an impression on both Lucille and her younger sister, Helen. Both sisters were taken in with the dark-eyed actor, and over the next 5 months, Booth played the sisters against each other. He started juggling the two of them, flirting and courting them both at the same time, until he seduced both of them.
Mm.
Lucille eventually finally discovered he was also sleeping with Helen, the younger sister. She blamed not Booth for seducing both of them, but her sister for sleeping with Booth.
Of course.
Absolutely. So Lucille was so betrayed that she quit the show, she never performed with her sister again, and it is quite notable that it was not Lucille's photograph, but Helen's that was found with Booth's body.
Ooh, yeah. That's a little...
Yeah. It's trashy. He's a trashy dude.
Yeah.
And, you slowly start to realize these are not necessarily, like, keepsakes where he's like, oh, I remember the love we shared.
Yeah, no, this is a trophy.
He's keeping trophies.
Yeah, exactly.
So he breaks up this sister act, and just how awful is it to break up a woman's relationship with her sister, ruin their career, and be like, I should take a photograph.
Exactly, right?
I
really want to remember this moment for the rest of my life. I'm going to stick this in my diary.
When I'm dying on a porch in Virginia with my spine paralyzed, I'd like to look back on this moment in my life.
Exactly. You know, this is really one of my greatest triumphs. Right up there with shooting the president.
Well, apparently he enjoyed it so much that he moved on to another sister act. So having ruined one, he moves on to Albany, New York, which is the next show in the circuit. There he reunites with an old flame named Henrietta Irving.
Okay.
Now, she is not one of the women pictured Which, for reasons that will become very clear soon.
Oh, excellent.
You know, he had met her many years ago on the circuit. He had seduced her a couple of times. And so when they got back together, like when he sees her when they're working together again, she's like, oh,
hey,
how you doing, buddy? And he's like, I'm the same. Indescribably randy. So unfortunately for Henrietta, this time she is not touring alone. She's touring with her younger sister, Marie. We know that Booth has a history with younger sisters. And even Henrietta is suspicious of him.
I love this. I'm sorry, I'm just imagining like Henrietta pulling Marie off to the side and she's just like,
no.
Now you listen here. I understand. I get it.
I get it.
He's
so hot.
He's so hot. The mustache really does it for you.
It's just
Don't do it.
Don't do it.
It's not worth it. She's gonna break your heart.
So she warns him. She warns him numbers of times. She swears. She goes, I will hurt you if you sleep with my sister. And
you know, that's just older sister behavior, though.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely.
Well,
no, like,
to be clear, she is sleeping with Booth at this time. Right?
Even better.
So they reunite. They're like, oh, we're working on the show together. And Booth's like,
hey. You want to get together?
Yeah, you know.
He's
like, this was a good thing. And Henrietta's like, sure. This is my sister Marie.
If you sleep with my sister,
I'm gonna hurt you. But Booth swears, he swears up and down, Henrietta, he only has eyes for her.
Of course.
She does apparently believe him, which is why it must have hurt her feelings so much when she caught him sneaking out of Marie's hotel room at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Okay, so now I need to know, though, does she follow through on the promise? Is there, like, a rusty spoon involved?
She, not only does she follow through on her promise, she follows through immediately.
Excellent.
She sees him coming out of Marie's hotel room at 3 o'clock in the morning at 3:02. 3:02, furious that she had been lied to and cheated on, she drew a knife, a dagger, and tried to kill him.
Love her.
So he descends from the hotel room down the hallway into this lobby. She comes out into the lobby. He's like talking with the doorman or something, and she just walks up with this knife.
And just stabs him.
So she rushes him in the lobby. She slashes at his stupid, lying, handsome face. And Wilkes, like, as she slashes down, so she comes down with the knife, like she's trying to stab his face. So the idea is she wanted to cut his face up so he would either die or not be beautiful anymore.
Sure. Yeah.
And so he throws his arm up, and while he manages to keep it from, like, cutting his face, it actually cuts a deep cut right across the temple, right at the tip of his hairline.
Okay.
So it cuts a deep scar, unable to kill him. Henrietta, now in a lobby full of people rushing her, she panics, she stabs herself.
Ooh.
And then she collapses, bleeding onto the floor.
Okay.
At this point, Booth flees, just runs away, leaving her behind.
Sure, of course.
Luckily, Henrietta did survive. She recovered.
Okay.
Took her 2 years in the hospital to recover.
This is 1860s.
Yeah, she did get stabbed.
Yeah.
So she eventually does recover. It takes her 2 years afterwards. Booth flees, gets patched up. In many photos of John Wilkes Booth, and if you have a photo of him in front of you, dear listener, you can see that his hair is set so that one side of his forehead is covered. It's because there's a scar there from where she stabbed him in the face. He was embarrassed by the scar and didn't really like to talk about it. Anyone who asked were told that it was inflicted by a jealous girl, and he just would laugh it off and be like, oh, just, you know, a jealous young girl.
Yes, of course.
Notably, he wore his hair like that always.
All the time.
So nobody asked about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
So that scar remained as a reminder of what he had done. Unsurprisingly, neither Henrietta nor Marie were in his final photo collection.
Oh my god.
But to be fair, he already had a much more permanent souvenir.
That's fair. That's very fair. I'm just imagining, though, like in one of those scenarios with one of these, you know, other girls, you know, the hair kind of like falls back as they're in the middle of, you know, different things. You know, she's gonna kiss him and like pushes it back. Oh, how did you get that scar?
Shut up. It's not important. What do you think about Abraham Lincoln? Never mind. But, so he continues on. In 1863, Henrietta is finally recovering. She's getting out of the hospital. Booth is moving on. He's now, of course, he's getting more and more popular. You know, stabs in the face, not really slowing his career down. He is now touring the country with a new flame. This time, a co-star named Fanny Brown.
Okay.
Who is, again, a young woman with a a little bit of a silly name. They are doing a production of Richard III that is touring around, and Fanny Brown is a very popular actress at this time.
Okay.
Both Henrietta Irving and the Western sisters were lower class actresses.
Sure.
And I don't want to imply that actresses were of high social standing. They're not.
Yeah.
At all.
No, I mean...
They were, like, literally in the social caste of, like, Reconstruction and pre, like, Civil War America. It went beggar, prostitute, actor.
Yeah.
No, that was it.
There's really not a lot.
You had to do these very emotional things on stage, which people considered improper.
Sure.
And they were always, you know, Booth wasn't the only man that was running around, you know, banging everything that moved.
Of course.
So it was considered, actresses were considered very, you know, like, were considered lesser women, which is unfair. But yes. Fanny Brown is very, very popular at this time. She's making a lot of money. She's doing a lot of performances. So they actually do a good bit of work to try and keep this affair secret.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense.
So they're trying to keep this hidden. So they keep it, they keep the affair quiet. So each time they stay in a hotel, they are booked in two different rooms. However, the rooms are always adjoining. Mm-hmm. So they always share a door. And it is, you know, it is widely known at this point that they would just...
Yeah.
Unlock the door. They would spend the night together. Absolutely, come on in. How do you feel about Abraham Lincoln? She contributed a final five photograph. She makes it into the top five.
Okay.
Fanny Brown does.
Top five.
And in fact, she got the most salacious photograph. So most of the photographs in this diary that he has are just headshots.
Yeah.
They're either like profile views, like you would see on a coin,
sure.
or they're like these kind of bust shots. Have you ever seen like a bust of like George Washington? It's just
absolutely.
Like the shoulders.
Like, yeah, you get like
and, like, the collar.
The shoulders, the collarbone.
The hairline,
and,
that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
She gives a full body photograph to him. And again, when I say full body,
yeah,
it's not as nasty as you might think.
Yeah, no. It's not that bad.
It's not that bad.
You know, these are the ones that would be like publicly like sold. Like,
yes, this
hey,
would be on a like a big marquee or something like
that.
Yeah,
it's like you know, you go to a concert and you're like, oh man, I really love the band members. I'm gonna
get this poster.
Get
this poster for $45.
Exactly. Let me get this piece of paper for like $45 and I'm gonna hang it in my room.
So her photograph is full body, she's smiling at the camera, and she is posed to like show off her figure. So I mean, and again, she's wearing petticoats and a full dress. So if you look these up, and you can see these. In the history of, like, kind of, like, figuring out who these women are, she was known as the Mysterious Beauty. Because for many years, there was no idea who these women were. So they were kept in a lock-and-key box in the department, I believe it was the Department of Justice had them. And this is very early Department of Justice.
Yeah.
So, like, one building in Washington, D.C.
One building.
A big one, but one building.
Sure.
And so nobody knew who these women were. Nobody knew kind of what their references were, who they were. And so they're misidentified a couple of different times as different actresses. But eventually all four are identified, but hers is unidentified. Until eventually a janitor, like, who apparently has, not a janitor, maybe like a caretaker of these photos, just takes one out without asking permission. And just goes and, like, makes a bunch of copies of it and then starts distributing it, trying to figure out who she is. So we do eventually figure out that the Mysterious Beauty, as she was called, is Fanny Brown. She was eventually, she was called the Mysterious Beauty until 1910, when someone finally recognized her as Fanny Brown.
Nice.
Their affair ends quite amicably.
Okay.
No one gets stabbed.
All right.
Serious? Nobody gets stabbed,
okay.
Which is nice. Disappointing. I would say if Henrietta had been a little quicker...
Honestly,
maybe a little quicker.
Can you imagine, like, I feel like that would be a great premise for, like, an alternate history sort of, like, novel.
what
if
Henrietta Irving
succeeded and shanked John Wilkes Booth in that hotel?
Well, it was strange. I'll talk about this a little bit further on, but Lincoln was doing some very unpopular things at this time, which kind of leads into this idea that feeds into this Greek hero, you know, ideal that Booth is building for himself.
Sure.
But the next one that they find is Effie Gurman. So she is a young actress. She is only 18 when John Wilkes Booth finds her, keeping in mind that most actresses started their career at 14, 15, younger.
Yeah.
So Booth hires her to replay the romantic lead for a theater company that he's starting. So he starts his theater company. She apparently was so taken by John Wilkes Booth, she loved him so much, that when he was shot 12 days after he's assassinated Lincoln, everybody knows he's the destroyer of worlds, he's terrible, he's awful. She is the only person that sent condolences to John Wilkes Booth's family. She sent a letter to his sister and said, I know that you're going through a lot. If you need anything, let me know. John Wilkes Booth was very kind to me, and he may have done some terrible things, but his kindness means a lot to me, meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
And so she is very sweet.
Yeah.
I don't know as much about her as I'd like. I do know some very cool things about her.
What are some of the coolest things? I do have some fun stuff. I'm ready.
He kept a photo with her. It was identified many years after the assassination, once reporters were allowed to examine the final items he carried. She was identified by a reporter with a very bad quote, which I will now read to you.
Oh, I'm so ready.
Yes. Miss Effie Gurman, once leading lady at Wallach's, a theater in the area, is one, referring to, of the photographs. It is a fair young face, strikingly beautiful. Miss Gurman, if living, is now an old woman. And they say she is fat. Which, I would just like to... This was 1891. This is in 1891 that she's identified by this reporter who says that she's fat now. And apparently, you know, in 1891, they hadn't invented manners yet.
Apparently? Oh my god. So, wait. So she was 18 when she meets John Wilkes Booth in what year?
I don't know what year he met. It's in the book, but I don't know. It's not relevant.
Still,
but...
she would still be, like, presumably, like, under 50.
There's a whole section in one of these research materials about her. She apparently did She apparently aged very gracefully from young ingenue roles into grandmother and mother roles.
Of course.
Which is theater code for she got fat. and they didn't want to have her as romantic leads anymore, so they made her, like, mothers and stuff like that. She apparently played very well. She continued being an actress, which most of these young romantic leads, like, do a bunch of shows, and then they're not considered beautiful enough or viable enough for the stage anymore, and then they just, like, die.
And then they're gone.
Yeah, a lot of this research involved. And then she died. And then she died. And then she died in a lunatic asylum. Which is where you sent women when they talked back to their husbands.
Exactly.
Which was, again, a bad thing about the 1800s. Not just the syphilis, also the lunatic asylums.
Also the lunatic asylums.
Now, I would like to say that, you know, fat or not, Effie Gurman was considered such a striking beauty. Her image has lived on in one of the most important buildings in the country. In the massive United States Capitol Rotunda, there is a big fresco called the Apotheosis of Washington. In the fresco, seated next to him is a goddess. That goddess is modeled in the likeness of Effie Gurman.
No way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no. So, fun fact, this past March, I actually went to Washington, D.C., and I did a bunch of, like, fun little tours and different things like that. I got a bunch of pictures. So, like, that's really cool.
It is, yeah. I think it's fantastic
that
she was so beautiful. They were like, no. So, George Washington is becoming a god. The apotheosis of Washington, right next to him. Effie Gurman.
I love that.
In 1891, some reporter's like, ah, I bet she's not pretty anymore.
Yeah,
I bet
she's
chunky and I hate it. Like, it's just...
She's clearly got the fat.
She's clearly terrible now. I love that. I stan Effie Gurman.
I love her.
She's very sweet.
Yeah,
she sent
honestly,
her condolence
like,
letter.
That is like a new level of sweet, though.
It
like,
is.
Like, hey, I realize that your brother shot the president, got paralyzed... in the spine and then died horribly. Bled out on a porch somewhere. But you know, I realize that must be hard for you, so I'm here if you need like a soup or something.
I'm here if you need some soup. Do you want to bring some soup?
You need a casserole?
Do you need a casserole? Ugh, I don't know why when someone passes away you're supposed to bring them casseroles. But I guess
quick, easy to reheat.
I guess
probably.
Well, the next woman is the woman who I unfortunately know the least about, which is Alice Gray. She also, like Gurman, worked for Booth at a theater company. She is the one of the few who is not documented, who is not proven to have slept with him.
Okay.
Gurman, it's probably.
It's a,
pretty
it's,
sure.
It's a probably.
It's like a 70%.
Sure.
Gray, it's like 50. Mm. Like, she was in his radar, and he hired her to be a romantic lead.
So probably.
He also kept her photograph, which
so
indicates to me...
Probably,
which
yeah.
indicates to me he probably did sleep with her, which is why he did. He does feel like the kind of person that would keep trophies.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
exactly.
Very gross.
Like that, it does seem like a kind of thing. Like if you're gonna keep a person's picture in
yeah.
your diary with a bunch of other pictures
of
women
you
definitely
have slept
with. Slept
with. Yeah.
Yeah, seems probable.
So before we get to the final photograph, there's some other women I want to talk about. So you remember how I said that in between each of these women, I'd like you to just self-insert
yeah,
into
self-insert,
like 12 prostitutes.
Yeah, like a dozen different prostitutes.
So I want to talk about some of those prostitutes now.
Oh, I'm so ready.
So there are two that are very, very historically relevant. One is Ella Starr. So she had a number of different names. Nellie Starr, Ella Turner, Ella Turner. Ella Starr is probably her stage name.
Still,
that is
a stage name.
It's
though.
A good name.
Like that right there, I could see that name in lights.
Well, you can probably see it on, you know, a chalkboard inside
yeah,
a brothel,
yeah.
Which is where she met John Wilkes Booth.
Mm-hmm.
So Ella Starr was one of John Wilkes Booth's favorite prostitutes.
Okay.
So he slept with a lot of prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very common at this time. So there is a section, pardon me, let me grab my reference material. There is a section of Washington, D.C. that was called the Hooker's Division. It's in what's now the present-day Federal Triangle. It was called Hooker's Division because it was where General Joe Hooker's troops were stationed when he was in charge of defending the city. It was just a coincidence. It was just a coincidence.
It was just a coincidence.
That it was
never,
actually full
was
of prostitutes.
Absolutely packed to the gills with brothels.
Absolutely. It was already known, were already called hookers before that general
yep,
ever
I'm,
was stationed
I,
there. So
that is like the happiest coincidence and also the saddest. And I love that.
Absolutely. So Ella is involved with John Wilkes Booth. She sees him quite a lot. She is quoted to be as fierce as a tigress in her devotion to him. She sent him lots and lots of notes. In fact, it is thought that the night before he assassinated Lincoln, he was with her. So on April 13th, 1865, he is sleeping with Ella Starr that night. He then goes to breakfast with the final woman I will talk about, but I want to talk about Ella Starr a little bit more.
Okay.
So Ella Starr is used as a... Ella Starr and another prostitute are used as integral parts of his plan. So she receives correspondence for him, she leaves notes, she takes packages to the post office.
So she's just part of the conspiracy then.
She is. She was never formally charged. But the women of the brothel and her herself were incarcerated for about 12 to 15 days afterwards, as they were like, anybody who was involved with Booth is getting wrapped up in this. We're going to incarcerate you. We're going to interrogate you. So she dropped off a couple of things. She dropped off some notes that would make sure that there were supplies waiting for the conspirators as they fled out of the city. Now, she claims she didn't know what she was doing.
Of course.
But it's also noted that many of the brothels and prostitutes were secessionist-leaning. Because they were lower class women, and so they often came. They were immigrants from other areas, and so Washington at this time had a lot of refugees from like Maryland and other border states that were having a lot of fighting.
Yeah.
So she probably did. This is not confirmed, but there is another prostitute who's involved. So there is a plot to get the Secretary of State, who I believe his name is William Seward. Now William Seward is known to enjoy the company of prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
So Booth gets one of his buddies and says, I'm going to go shoot Lincoln tonight. You are going to go shoot Seward. He is going to be busy at this time of night, and his door is going to be unlocked. How do I know this? Because I have an inside person. Who else could he have had as an inside person? So that was another young woman who was involved. Now, there's a reason the Secretary of State was not assassinated that night, is because while apparently this prostitute did do her work, she managed to make sure that the conspiracy could go off without a hitch. The man Booth sent to go shoot Seward sat in the hotel bar trying to work up the nerve, drank a bunch, and got so drunk he couldn't do it. He couldn't pull it off. He was like,
I
don't feel so good.
Oh my god. I'm sorry,
it's funny.
If you're gonna plot to assassinate the president, the secretary of state, and the vice president all in one night,
mm-hmm.
maybe you should like vet the guy first and make sure he's reliable.
Yes. Well, you know, he was gathering. So this is another thing, and of course, a lot of people of Abraham Lincoln knowledge will tell you this. This wasn't the first plot that Booth had. He had a half baked plot about 3 or 4 months before this, where he was attempting to kidnap Lincoln.
Ooh.
He wanted to kidnap Lincoln, and he wanted to trade Lincoln back to the Union in return for the release of a lot of Confederate prisoners.
Okay.
So the guy that he gets to do this is a member of that crew from earlier. A lot of that crew had backed out because they were like, Booth, you're insane. This isn't going to work. Like, you're going to get us all killed.
Yeah.
And so one of the few men that was like, nah, we could probably kidnap the president was John Booth. You know, Booth just calls him up and goes, hey.
Hey.
So the kidnapping, meh, done with that.
What do you think?
About murder. So.
Just, you know, he's the Secretary of State's going to be here in this room.
Busy.
Literally just as occupied as one man can be.
I can guarantee you he won't have his gun on him. he will be unarmed.
Not that kind
and
of gun.
Undressed.
Well, I'm so sorry.
So, all these prostitutes that I'm mentioning, again, this is very common. Like I said, Hooker's division was just a part of the city. Right, you would ride in carriages. Like, Lincoln is often noted to have rode in carriages, and like these brothels full of women were just like, hey, Lincoln, screw you! We don't like you! We think you're bad! We think you're bad. So they were everywhere.
Yeah.
They were, you know, they were I'm not sure if they were legal, but they were certainly well tolerated. Tolerated to the point where you could advertise.
Sure, yeah.
So there is another prostitute that John Wilkes Booth is involved in, and this is Louise Wooster. Now, she is down in Mobile, Alabama. And so this is very early in his career.
Yeah, she's a distance away from all
this. Yeah, she's a distance away from all this. This is quite a ways before all of the, you know, the hullabaloo with the assassination. Booth is doing what we know he does. He met her. He was on tour. He was going to be there for, like, 3 months. He found a prostitute that he liked, and he just immediately was like, I love you. I love you very much. You're the love of my life. Which is what he says to all these women that he, you know, gets involved with. And he apparently runs the lines with her in their little bordello, in this little room that they share when he, you know, comes to see her. And she's like, do you ever think I could be an actress? And he's like, of course you could.
Mm-hmm.
I love you, therefore you're perfect and special. And she begs him when the tour is over, he's like, well, off to the next city. And the next woman, she's like,
take me with you.
Yeah. And he goes, sure, I have to go make some money in another city, like my dad did, and then I'll come back and get you. And so she leaves, he leaves, she waits for him for about a year. Nothing.
Never comes back,
never speaks to her again. She tries acting for a couple of years. It doesn't really go well, and she's like, well, I guess I'll just go back to being a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
I was okay at that. I don't love it, you know, because my life expectancy is like 22
yes.
as a prostitute.
Because, you know, syphilis is a thing.
Syphilis is definitely, we'll get to that. But she leaves Mobile, and she goes to Birmingham, which is exploding with activity at this point. And I would like to say, just, you know, her life expectancy might have been short as a prostitute. She moves to Birmingham and becomes one of the most successful women I've ever read about. She goes far and beyond. So she actually, where's my little article here? So she leaves Booth behind and goes to become the most famous madam in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh my God.
So she makes a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
She runs this brothel.
Yeah.
And she makes her money because she sets it across the street from, like, City Hall. She goes, there's City Hall, this is where my brothel's gonna be, like a block away, there's a police station, I'm gonna go spend a lot of money making sure that the police are here the moment we need them,
yeah.
And then she starts getting all these higher class, like, clients,
yeah.
all these senators and politicians,
yeah.
people who, if you did raid her brothel, it would be embarrassing, right? So the police are like, well, we can't really go in there because the chief of police goes there, I can't arrest my boss.
Exactly.
So she makes a lot of money. Then there is a cholera outbreak in Birmingham in 1873. So many people, anybody who's rich, who's got money, is like, there's a bunch of cholera here. We're going to go to our country homes. We're going to flee to our farms. We'll go rough it with only 2 servants for a little while. And she stays because she can't leave. The women that she takes care of, the women that she protects, they have no money to leave, right? All of her money is tied up in these buildings and these businesses that she owns. And so she turns her brothels into cholera treatment centers. She becomes the leader of, like, the cholera, like, treatment. She comes to the forefront of all of her brothels and bordellos become treatment facilities. People come and they get treated for cholera. And she and the prostitutes don't get sick because they have such strong immune systems.
Oh my God.
Because they're being constantly, you know, thrust in. Excuse me. That was a bad turn of phrase. Dear listener, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to hurt your ears with that. They're being constantly confronted with, shall we say, the most vicious of diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So she actually becomes basically one of the founding members of, like, the healthcare scene in Birmingham. She has an award in the Birmingham community. She has the Lou Worcester Public Health Award that is named in her honor. It's something that's presented annually by the University of Alabama to recognize individuals, groups, or organizations who are public health heroes.
I love this woman.
I just like to say, she left Booth behind. So far behind.
So far behind. No.
So,
like, oh my God.
She becomes incredible.
I aspire to be that petty. Like, can you imagine, though, like, just, well, this man left me, so I'm gonna go, and I'm gonna make my own way.
I'm gonna go make my own city with hookers and cholera treatment facilities. So she goes and does this. She eventually passes away. She died in May of 1913, and when she did, hundreds of empty black carriages drove by the funeral home to pay respects to the local hero. They were all empty because they came from some of the most high-profile men in the city. And they were like, well, I can't attend the funeral because then everybody knows that I probably also have syphilis. Reginald, take the carriage down. Hundreds of these carriages showed up.
Oh my God.
She was incredibly well loved.
That is so
cool. Which
is
super cool. If you'd like to learn more about her, you should.
I think I very well might after this.
Absolutely.
Like this lady just sounds incredible.
And I've mentioned syphilis a couple of times.
Yes.
Syphilis was rampant. It was known as the French disease because a lot of soldiers got it while fighting in France, and then the name just kind of stuck.
Yes.
But a lot of people had syphilis.
It has nothing to do with the ménage à trois.
It has nothing to do with the ménage à trois. But if you do a ménage à trois, you are one third more likely to get syphilis. So, for those of you guys who are bad at math, that is 30%. 30% more likely to get syphilis. So at this time, there's no treatment for syphilis. None. In fact, syphilis continues to be a problem. So just some notable people who have had syphilis in Booth's family. All of them.
Literally all of them.
His father had it. His father had it. His father was also a horrible alcoholic.
Yes.
Edwin had it. His brother had it. And Edwin was pretty chill. Like, Edwin was a great tragedian. He was a very calm and collected actor. He would do... just a kind of gross note. Both Edwin and John Wilkes played Othello, which, isn't it gross?
Yeah.
Isn't it gross? If you don't know, Othello is a Shakespearean play about a Moor, or also known as, like, an African-American person who is kind of, like, in a different place. He's running this small city, and then he kills his wife. To be clear, both Edwin and John Wilkes Booth were playing Othello, a black man, on stage.
Yep.
For rapturous applause.
Yes.
So anyway, they all have syphilis, so...
Of course.
Now, it's not confirmed whether or not John Wilkes Booth had syphilis, but I would like to read you a quote about whether or not he had syphilis from a couple of people. Here we go.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been a miracle if John's lechery did not result in him contracting a venereal disease.
If it wasn't syphilis, it had to have been something else.
Absolutely. John McCullough, one of John Wilkes Booth's closest friends, was the first actor whose disease was tabloid news. And McCullough said of John, he was a wonderful companion of disease. Disease was a typical 19th century euphemism for syphilis.
Oh my God.
Now, this word, of course, was taboo in polite society. It was shameful to mention because it implied that they were having sex outside of marriage.
Of course.
John and McCullough often shared a room together. Both were womanizers. Both 100% had syphilis. A couple of people theorized that the syphilis was acting upon him in those last days.
Mm.
Because syphilis does a lot of things to your brain.
Yeah.
It makes you upset and angry and irrational. And John Wilkes Booth was upset and angry and irrational. He was also, horrible racist.
Yes.
Unfun fact about John Wilkes Booth, he was present at the hanging of John Brown, which is the person who actually led this, attempted to start a slave rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
So when John Brown was captured, there were a lot of worries that slaves would rise up or that people would show up to try and rescue him from being hung.
Yep.
John Wilkes Booth volunteered to go guard John Brown to make sure that he got hung. And in fact, he did so by showing up. He saw a friend of him who was part of a militia and was like, "Where are y'all going?" And he was like, "Oh, we're gonna go, you know, make sure that John Brown gets hung and like there's some unrest." And John Wilkes Booth's like, "Can I come?" "No, you don't have a uniform. What if I bought your uniform?" Uniform off of him and just showed up and like, you know, was there. So bad guy, real bad guy. We're gonna come to the last woman here, who is arguably the most influential,
mm-hmm.
And the one who was the most forefront in John Wilkes Booth's mind. This is also the one he saw last.
Okay.
So the last woman here was a woman named Lucy Hale. Now, Lucy Hale, if you have ever, you know, heard that name, is quite a famous young lady. She was the daughter of an American senator and the ambassador to Spain. So she was quite involved with Miss Hale. He sent numerous letters to his mother and to his brother saying that he was engaged to a young woman in Washington. She and he were secretly engaged. She was his fiancée.
Okay.
Now, this was not yet publicly announced, obviously, because her father hated Booth. Didn't care for him. It is unclear, it is undocumented, I should say, whether or not her father knew about this.
Mm-hmm.
He most likely did. It's almost impossible to kind of perceive. Like, the idea that a father at this time, when every unmarried woman is chaperoned at pretty much all times, wouldn't know that his daughter was, you know, engaged to somebody is unrealistic. It's quite likely, however, that he just disapproved heavily of Booth. But what is he to tell his daughter? You can't see him?
Yeah.
She's going to just, you know, love him harder. That's how it works.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, he's an actor. So, like,
absolutely.
Like, he's already in the public eye. There's the whole, you know.
So they met. They both lived in the National Hotel at one point in Washington, D.C. So her father just kept rooms. Lucy lived there with her mom. And John Wilkes Booth lived on a different floor. So they would often see each other. But John Wilkes Booth actually met her a little bit differently. So John Wilkes Booth decided to do the most dramatic drama queen thing he could, and he sent her an anonymous love letter on Valentine's Day to try and win her over.
Okay.
Now, Valentine's Day was one of the few times where anonymous letters were socially acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
If you received an anonymous letter from a stranger on Valentine's Day, today it would be creepy.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, if it's just like a letter to your address where you live.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's
that's
gross.
Yeah, no, that's a lot.
And it's with this letter in particular, you might be kind of creeped out.
Okay.
So I'm going to read a bit of the letter here. I might skip over if it seems a little too boring, but it's pretty weird. So he starts the letter here. "My dear Miss Hale, were it not for the license with a time-honored observance of this day allows," basically, because it's Valentine's Day, I feel comfortable sending you this.
Yes.
"You resemble in a most remarkable degree a lady very dear to me, now dead. And your close resemblance to her surprised me the first time I saw her." So his opening line is, hey, it's Valentine's
Day. Because it's
Day.
Valentine's Day, I'm just going to come out and say it. You look like this dead chick I once really was into.
I was really into this girl and she died. And you... You could be my second. You could be the second one. So this must be my apology for any rudeness noticeable. To see you has indeed afforded me a melancholy pleasure, if you can conceive of such. And such should we never meet, nor I ever see you again, believe me, I shall always associate you in my memory with her, who was very beautiful, and whose face, like your own, I trust, was a faithful index of gentleness and amiability." That was, I want to be clear, one sentence. This man needs an editor. That is the longest run-on sentence.
God.
The creepiest run-on sentence,
perhaps. Just not only does... He doesn't even mention it just once. No, he mentions it twice.
She's super dead.
She's, like, so dead.
Have I mentioned how dead she is?
Have I mentioned that she's passed away? She seems... Perhaps I should mention it a third time. No, two will suffice.
Two will suffice. She was so nice before she died. And you reminded me of her. With 1,000 kind wishes for your future, happiness I am to you, a stranger. So he doesn't even sign this. So he's trying to be this smooth customer. He sends her the secret admirer letter. He's also kind of mixing in these things. You can see in his writing, he's mixing in these themes of, like, he's like this tragic person.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, this woman I loved is dead.
Yeah.
You remind me of her. And I just, if you would never speak to me again, if you'd never see me again, oh, I'll always remember you because of how wonderful she was.
I'm sorry.
Drama queen or not.
Absolute drama queen.
Lucy loved it.
Of course she did.
She loved it.
Of course she did.
Absolutely loved it. They soon struck up a romance. She attended one of his shows. She sent him flowers after the show. They struck up this romance. By 1865, they are being seen publicly together, and they get secretly engaged. So Hale actually used her father's influence to do a lot for Booth. She got him into places that he didn't need to be. In fact, she actually got him tickets to Lincoln's second inauguration.
Okay.
She actually got him tickets.
Yeah.
So Booth was there at his second inauguration.
So Lucy's basically over here, and she's like, oh, you know, let me see if I can pull some strings. You know, my dad's up there in the ranks.
And now her dad, I mean, of course, after the fact, is like, I had no idea who these tickets were for. I thought they were for Lucy. Interesting about Lucy, a young man who was also interested in Lucy, Robert Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln's son.
Oh my god.
So, I mean, and Robert and her never really hit it off. They sent a couple letters back and forth, but I just love to think that she's like, do I go with Robert Lincoln or, I don't know, the most violently racist man in America? At this point, she doesn't know he's violent, but she knows he's racist.
No, clearly, I must choose the most violently racist man in America. Have you seen his mustache?
Absolutely. So, at the second inauguration is actually where it's thought that Booth kind of codified, he decided what he was going to do. At the second inauguration, Lincoln talks about the fact that the Emancipation Proclamation frees all the slaves under Southern control. It doesn't free slaves in the North, although slavery was abolished in most places in the North. Although, to be clear, the Emancipation Proclamation was not like, yay, all slaves are free. It was like, hey, if you want to come fight for us, you know, like, Lincoln was not a perfect person. We do glamorize him because he got assassinated. He wasn't awesome. Now's a great time to kind of bring up why Booth was so angry at Lincoln. Lincoln had done some things that were quite unpopular. Lincoln had suspended habeas corpus, which is, if you don't know, which is the right to be, you have to be charged with a crime to be imprisoned.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. So at that time, Lincoln had suspended a habeas corpus because Maryland was a border state. So Maryland had voted to stay in the Union. However, 49 to 55% of the Marylanders didn't want to do that, right?
Okay.
It passed in a vote in the Congress of Maryland, but then there's all these rural people who are like, I don't believe in this. We're a Southern state. We have Southern heritage. And so there was a lot of worry that Maryland was going to rise up. There will be these militias that would form and that would attack. So Lincoln suspends habeas corpus, starts imprisoning people. He imposes martial law in Baltimore, which is in Maryland, in that city there, to make sure that nothing gets out of hand. And there are Union soldiers that come through Maryland. They get pelted with rocks, and they get pelted and, like, assaulted. The Union troops fire back because they're being hit.
Yeah.
A lot of people die. So all of this is happening, and this convinces Booth that Lincoln is a tyrant, right? And then he's like, ooh, and you know what tyrants need? To be assassinated.
Yeah, tyrants just need, you know,
this narrative starts to form. He's like, oh, Lincoln's a tyrant. And now, there were thoughts that Lincoln wasn't going to get reelected. It was actually not very, it wasn't sure that Lincoln was going to be reelected. In fact, it was more likely he wasn't going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And if that happened, and a more pro-peace president was elected, the Confederacy would have been able to sue for peace and say, oh, let's do a white peace or let's do a status quo thing. We'll keep what we've got, you keep what you've got, and we'll do a ceasefire, or we'll end the war for now.
Yeah.
Which would have been great for the Confederacy, because then all these things would have, you know, they could have rebuilt themselves.
Sure.
But Lincoln manages to win re-election. It's an iffy thing, but he managed to win a re-election, and in his inauguration, he announces that he is planning on giving the vote to emancipated black people, right? And now, it's in no like clear terms, but he's like, those that fight for us deserve, as all fighting men do, the right to control their own country, and heavily implies that if you are as an African-American, if you fight for the Union, you'll receive the right to vote, which, to be clear, did not happen.
Yeah.
But he implies it, and Booth goes...
Booth is violently racist.
Violently racist. He turns to somebody who's sitting with him, and the quotes vary. One of them has the N-word in it, so I'm not going to use that one. He says something to the effect of, that's it. He's going to ruin us. I have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
This is where he's like, he has to die. I have to kill him. So he decides that's what he's going to do. He starts putting these plans into action. Meanwhile, he is still engaged to Lucy Hale. So Senator Hale was recently appointed as the ambassador to Spain. Again, it is unclear whether or not he knew that Lucy was deeply involved with Booth. I think it was unlikely. He was oblivious. His wife certainly wasn't oblivious to the fact. They had breakfast together. They had dinner together. They would talk often. And so she, at the very least, knew that Booth was courting Hale. And both Booth and Lucy had rings. So it's very unlikely that at the very least...
So Mrs. Hale is over here and she's just like, I see what's going on. You guys think you're so sly. It's not happening.
Absolutely. The engagement was never made public. Very lucky for Lucy. They were involved right up to the end on April 14th. So remember that... So the night of April 13th, he's with Ella Starr.
Yeah.
A prostitute.
A prostitute. And then in the morning, he's like...
He goes to the National
Hotel. Hi, honey. Are you ready for breakfast?
He goes and has breakfast with his fiance. So he goes out, he does some things that day. And then if you ever want to look into the assassination... There's a lot of things that happen that day. He goes over to the theater. He's like, oh, is Lincoln going to be here today? Just checking. Mm-hmm. And they go, yeah, Lincoln's going to be here, but, Grant isn't coming. Mm-hmm. And Lincoln's like, Booth is like, oh, man, I was going to shoot both of them.
Yeah.
I guess I'll just get Lincoln.
I guess I can just get Lincoln. Just the one.
He goes in, he sets up the box so he can get into it later. He comes back. He has dinner with Lucy that night. And as he left dinner, he holds Lucy's hands and he quotes Hamlet. Because, again, he's a tryhard. He says, Nymph, in thy orisons, which is prayers, be all my sins remembered.
Yes.
Which, after the fact, is a little bit like, don't forget me.
Yep, no.
I'm going to go do something bad, but I'm going to do something bad for thee. And, again, just what an absolute scenery-chewing drama queen.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Absolutely. He leaves her and her mother at the dinner table. He goes to Ford's Theater, shoots Lincoln, and then just a few days after that, he is found with all five of these photographs on. He bleeds out on that porch, and his last words are useless. Wasn't that a fun story, children?
That is a beautiful story. I feel like that's a really fitting end, though. Just
it is
useless.
Yeah, it was.
You know, like it's very rare. I feel. That a person's last words so perfectly and succinctly capture the essence of a person in their entirety. And this guy, like, you know, he's on his deathbed, he's bleeding out on a porch, he's paralyzed, and the only thing that he can say is useless. Which, congratulations, sir, you nailed it.
You absolutely were useless.
Yeah, good job. Good job, man.
Absolutely. Now, these women were all wonderful, and I'm really glad that they, you know, they get their own stories.
Yeah.
They deserve to be remembered.
All of these ladies are, like, with, like, varying degrees of just badass.
They
like,
absolutely were.
I really want to learn, like, way more about Lou Wooster after all that. Like,
I will
she's
let you borrow this book.
I will
if
I
you would
it.
Like it.
Yeah, no, she sounds just really cool.
But, so the end of his life, I would like to say, like, he did a bad thing. And he deserved to be punished. And the last 12 days apparently were awful for him. So he expected that these secessionists, these southern states, are going to, like, welcome him with open arms.
Mm-hmm.
No. They are like, you shot the president?
You shot the president?
Absolutely. So nobody's really willing to take him in. He and his conspirator are riding. John Wilkes Booth at some point has broken his leg.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that he jumps on the stage, breaks his leg. Some people say it happened at a different time.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know that when he was found, he had his boot cut open because his leg was all busted up.
Yeah.
He writes in his diary. Just a poor little man. He writes in his diary, and I have the quote in here somewhere, and I'm going to find it, if you give me 1 second.
Absolutely.
So here it is, right here. So I just want to say, he puts these thoughts down in this diary, and this is really the kind of the culmination of what he believes he was doing. This is what he thinks about what he's done towards the end of the day here.
Okay.
I am here in despair, hunted like a dog. Wet, cold, and starving, every man's hand against me. And why? For doing what Brutus was honored for? What made William Tell a hero? He thinks he's a hero. He thinks he has, you know, done these absolutely, this wonderful thing. My action was purer than either of theirs. I struck for my country and that alone. I struck boldly. I can never repent it, although we hated to kill.
You tried to kill three people in one night. You planned to kill three people in one night. You also planned to, like, kidnap the president before that. So, you know, are you really sure? Are you really sure that you regret it?
So that was what he said. That was what he did. And then what was the last thing he wanted to do here? Oh yes, sorry. And here's the name of that person who did shot him. Who shot him? Sergeant Thomas P. Boston Corbett. He did shoot him. A little note about Corbett, the man who shot him.
Yeah.
Corbett self-castrated himself. He was a religious zealot. He self-castrated himself.
That was not what I was expecting you to tell me about Corbett, but thank you for that wonderful piece of historical knowledge. I will take it to my grave.
He said when he shot him that Providence directed his hand. Apparently, once he was shot, unable to move, John Wilkes Booth, with a little bit of energy, cried out, "Kill me, kill me." And then Corbett said, "No, we're going to get a doctor, bringing you back alive." John bled out on that porch. All those photos were found. And then the last words he said were useless. One of his last sentences were, though, "Tell my mother I died for my country." And I would like to say, he never once, although he had many opportunities to, he never once enlisted in the Confederate Army. Never once. Didn't enlist in the Confederate Army.
Of course not.
No.
He was perfectly content to, you know,
sweep his way across the United States
absolutely. And play Hamlet.
Absolutely. And to be clear, once the borders closed, he never went back south.
Of course.
He just continued to play in the north.
Of course, because the south didn't have money.
No, it didn't have any money. So that was John Wilkes Booth, not only an assassin, but a man who gave syphilis to undoubtedly so many people.
Just infinite.
And
infinite people.
And truly, this is really the story of Effie German, Alice Gray, Louise Wooster, Ella Starr, Lucy Hale. I'm going to forget their names, and I absolutely shouldn't. Effie German, who might be fat, but thank you very much, is on the rotunda of the Capitol.
Thank you very much,
Louise Wooster, who ran cholera places in Birmingham. These women are who we should remember.
Absolutely.
They just happen to all sleep with the same dirtbag.
You know, we all make bad decisions.
We've all slept with toxic men who think they're Greek heroes.
Yeah, totally.
Absolutely.
That's like everybody's type, really.
It is everybody's type. Absolutely. And then, of course, if you want to learn more about John Wilkes Booth, there's a lot of information about him. You can learn all about the Knights of the Golden Circle, which he was a part of, which are this group of Confederate spies that attempted to do things. He went to a lot of trips to Canada because that was there was actually a big Confederate base in Montreal.
Okay.
Because Canada was like, we don't really mind if the United States has a war. Do you guys want a little secret headquarters up here? And so he spent some time like with Confederate people up there. There's a lot of interesting history about him, but I think the women are very special.
Yeah, no.
And I'm glad we know who they are, but I think that's it for me. Do you have any final thoughts?
No. Thank you very much for sharing all of this wonderful knowledge with me. And I really look forward to, you know, kind of digging into this a little bit more myself.
Absolutely. We'll do it again. We'll do it again. And you'll tell me whatever Havana Syndrome is.
Perhaps.
Fantastic.
Yes.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed it, ladies and gentlemen. This has been Haunted History with Asher Brooks. Like I said, this is part two. If you want to listen to part one, which talks about Sons of Sam, the 44 caliber killer, you can watch part one of this episode. It'll be right above this one on wherever you read your podcast. So if you enjoyed yourselves, please like it, share it with other people. I want to be famous really, really bad. Yeah, that's kind of my only thing in life. So you'll have a wonderful day. I love you very much. And don't sleep with John Wilkes Booth.
Don't sleep with John Wilkes Booth.
Don't sleep with John Wilkes Booth.